Hello and welcome to Sir Life England Cancer UK's second podcast. This podcast is adapted from our April 2021 meeting where Dr. Robert Metcalfe from the Christie Hospital in Manchester hosted a gathering to talk about treatment options for metastatic disease. As you may know, Salivary Gland Cancer UK operates internationally. We provide information, we provide support, we provide reliable knowledge, and we provide the opportunity to meet with other patients and carers and to hear about the latest research updates. Our next meeting is in July. Get in touch if you'd like to join us. Dr. Metcalfe starts with defining what we mean by metastatic disease and when surgery might be considered.
Just first of all, to define what I mean by recurrent or metastatic salivary gland cancer, I mean, I'm sure, again, most will probably have that kind of clear in their mind, but just for those that don't, you know, most patients with salivary gland cancers present to their GP with a lump in their side of their face or in their mouth. And normally it is a localized cancer at diagnosis. So most patients have surgery as their first treatment. And that surgery is given with curative intent, so to remove all the disease that's there. And then a proportion of patients after surgery would have radiotherapy or chemoradiotherapy, essentially to try and reduce the risk of recurrence at that site. But so, and to present, say that in a different way, is to increase the chance of cure. Okay, so that's what most patients with salivary gland cancer have that as their first treatment. Occasionally, people present when they're first seen by, you know, their medical team, and it's actually not operable. It's either too large a diagnosis or it's already spread somewhere else. Then the patient group that I see normally, I've actually gone through that before and then have what you call evidence of recurrent or metastatic disease. And what we mean by that is recurrent just means it has come back at the same site, and or metastatic just means it has come back somewhere else. So that's the setting in which we're discussing these different treatment options, recurrent or metastatic salivary gland cancers. So the first thing is surgery. What is the role for surgery? And surgery does have a role in some patients with recurrent or metastatic salivary gland cancers. And there's two clear ways in which surgery could be beneficial. So some patients might have locally recurrent disease. So they've had their first operation with or without radiotherapy, and it has come back at the same site. And often the first question that's then asked is, if it's come back at the same site, can you have some sort of further operation? People sometimes call it a salvage surgery to resect what has come back once again with cure, you know, the chance of cure, trying to get rid of it, all the disease that's come back. So that's pretty much always the first question that's asked if there's evidence of locally recurrent disease. The general considerations, if you want to have another, you know, bite at the cherry, another chance at trying to get rid of it, is that how confident are you that that's the only site at which it has returned? And so normally you would have, you know, scans, either CT scans or PET CT scans to look for any evidence of distant recurrence. But if there's no distant recurrence, if the only site of recurrence is local recurrence, and if the surgical team think that surgery is possible, then that's, you know, that's the best first choice in salivary gland cancers, surgery for locally recurrent disease. So there is a situation when patients might have recurrence that has come back in another part of the body, but you may still only have a single site of recurrence. So occasionally, patients might have a long interval following their first presentation, their first operation, and then however it's picked up, either with symptoms or with some sort of screening scan, they're found to have, again, just one site of recurrence, maybe in the lung. I mean, it could be anywhere, but often with salivary gland cancer, with adenoid cystic, it's in the lungs. If there's just a single site of recurrence, Again, if it's felt to be operable, surgery is often the first, or the question, the first question that is asked is surgery possible to remove that that area? And the sort of principle that you apply to this surgical, you know, decision making, as in the question, can we operate or not? One of the questions you would want to know is, what is the interval between the first operation and the time to recurrence, the time at which the recurrence has happened? The reason that's important is it tells you a bit about the biology of what's going on in that individual. So if a patient's had a really long interval from their first operation of 5 years, 10 years, and then it's just a single site, generally speaking, surgeons think that they're more likely to be able to do good by operating on that site. Because, you know, if you had another 10-year disease-free interval after that, then I think people would think it's beneficial. And the other end of the spectrum is if people have, you know, when they first present, have their operation and then immediately after their operation have just a single site of recurrence, it does make it slightly more questionable what the benefits of surgery are in that setting. And it's a bit of a sort of sliding scale between the two, really. Occasionally, people would have surgery, you know, even if it was straight after, but it's more of a nuanced discussion with the surgical team. So that's kind of in a nutshell, in 3 minutes, that's surgery for recurrent or metastatic disease, and it does have a role. There's one other very different context in which surgery has a role, which is even if patients do have multiple sites of recurrence, and you wouldn't expect surgery to be with the intent of getting rid of all the disease that's there. Occasionally, if you've got, for instance, recurrence affecting the spine, the spinal bones, and it's near to the spinal cord, and at risk of compressing the spinal cord, then surgery would be considered to remove it and either stop the disease compressing the spinal cord or reduce the risk of it compressing if it looked like that was kind of an imminent complication. And similarly, if you had recurrence affecting the hip bone, for instance, and either threatening to cause or causing a hip fracture, even if you had other sites of disease, you would often discuss with the surgeons at that point and consider surgery, not with the intent of getting rid of it all, but with the intent of stabilizing the hip, and which would obviously have significant benefit in terms of improving someone's mobility or stopping them losing their mobility. So there are some settings in which surgery would be considered as well, even if it's not the only site of recurrence. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the key some of the key considerations. When a medical oncologist will go back to the surgeons and discuss the case with the surgeons when there's recurrence or distant metastasis.
In a situation where you have multiple mets, for example, in the lungs, what do we do?
So this is, if you've got multiple sites of recurrence, then unless you're trying to remove all the sites of recurrence, then surgery isn't given or isn't carried out with the intent of improving survival time. Okay, you know, if you're only removing a small part of the disease that's present in the body, then it's not going to impact on the sort of the overall course of the disease. So you wouldn't expect that really. But in the same way, I said sometimes you would you might operate if the disease is near the spinal cord. Or sometimes you would operate if it was threatening to fracture a hip. So, there are circumstances where a single site might be, normally it's something like that. It's the in the back, the thing we worry about the most is the spinal cord. So they're the sorts of situations when you would think about surgery.
So how do these mets form? How does cancer spread? Can mets seed other mets?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes. I think it does. You know, the cells. So the question is, you know, when you get a recurrence or an area, a site of metastasis, from which part of the disease has that arisen? And I think theoretically it can arise from any part of the disease, because if you think, you know, how cancers spread, again, this is in general terms, not specific to any particular subtype, how they spread is, you know, if you've got a lump of tumor, that's like literally billions of individual cells. And we know that any new site normally starts from just a single cell that's successfully managed to break away from a tumor, get into the circulation either via the, you know, bloodstream or the lymphatic sort of system, and then goes around the circulation and comes out again and finds a, you know, a particular part of the body that it's able to survive and grow in. Now, which cells cause that and from which site of the disease? Well, actually, that theoretically, any cell from any site of the disease could cause that. I mean, in my mind, I would say a cell that's already successfully metastasized, you know, already successfully spread to another part of the body and come out of the bloodstream again and sort of, you know, formed a colony there, well, that's already got the ability to do that. Whereas a cell that's in a primary site hasn't yet demonstrated that ability. But these are more, it's more of a theoretical thing. Mm-hmm. So okay. I think the answer is yes. Yeah, I've forgotten exactly how you worded the question. The answer is yes, those sites of recurrence can seed further sites of recurrence, yeah.
Is this the same for all salivary gland cancers? Do they all act in the same way?
From a surgical perspective then, just to try and maybe narrow it down a bit, two different subtypes of salivary gland cancers. So, you know, given what I said around time to recurrence being an important consideration, just it's how adenoid cystic normally behaves. Many people know that. Compared with many tumor types, adenoid cystic tends to have a very long, or it's much more likely to have a very long interval between primary surgery and recurrence. So this issue around surgery for recurrent or metastatic disease is much more of a relevant issue for patients with adenoid cystic compared with both other salivary gland cancer subtypes or many other salivary gland subtypes, and also compared to many other cancer types. So, you know, in common cancers like lung cancer, for instance, if it's going to come back, it tends to come back quite quickly, and surgery is very infrequently really thought about. But I'm sure if you're discussing with other patients, particularly with adenoid cystic, you'll see disproportionately compared to other tumor types, surgery, and these are the treatment of radiotherapy, ablative therapy are much more likely to be considered. So.
Now let's move on to radiotherapy.
So to move on to radiotherapy, I mean, I would say conceptually, radiotherapy is very similar to surgery. You know, it's carried out in a different way, but what you're trying to achieve is the same, really. So radiotherapy, like surgery, is a, you know, it's a localized treatment. You're only treating the site at which you're irradiating. You're not treating any other part of the body. It's a bit more obvious with surgery because someone goes in with a knife and kind of, you know, makes a, you know, cut and leaves a scar, and you sort of know that obviously not treating anywhere else. I mean, with radiotherapy, you can't really see anything, but it's the same concept. You're only treating the site that's being irradiated. And so the same principles that applied to this surgical decision making also apply to this radiotherapy decision making. So if you have local recurrence, you can have radiotherapy. And you would again think about it if it's the only site of the disease. But the other consideration that's sort of specific to radiotherapy is if someone has had radiotherapy previously to that same site, there's normally a sort of maximum exposure to radiotherapy that any part of the body will tolerate. So in general, it's difficult, or you can't re-irradiate, so give further radiation if you've already had a maximum dose of radiation to one area. There are exceptions to that. So sometimes you may not have had a maximum dose, and sometimes there may be a very long interval between that first exposure to radiation and sort of the point at which you're considering further radiation. And as I'm sure many people know, it's not really my area of expertise. I'm not involved in the radiotherapy decision making for any of my patients. But I do know that it's something I would discuss with a radiation oncologist. Even if a patient has had previous radiotherapy, if it's a long enough interval, I would discuss with the radiation oncologist whether they will consider re-irradiation. And then it's often down to a discussion between the radiation oncologist and the patient around the risks and benefits. And there are increased risks of radiotherapy, and the increased risk is you can get the tissues don't heal, and you can be left with a sort of, you know, an open wound even at the site of radiation. So it's a really big risk, because that you know, if that happens, then that's there for the rest of your life. It's not something that you want to be left with. But in principle, you would consider radiation for localized recurrence in the same way you would consider surgery. And you would also consider radiation for distant sites of recurrence if you felt they weren't operable, but they were only the only site of disease. You would think about high-dose radiation. In the same way I talked about the spinal cord, often if we discuss with surgeons around if there's a site of disease that's threatening the spinal cord and the surgeons say, look, it doesn't look operable, then patients would be offered radiotherapy normally as a routinely in that situation. And also if there are areas of bone involvement that look like they are risking fracturing the bones or symptomatic, you would consider radiotherapy as well as surgery. The other thing with radiotherapy is you'd be a bit more, whereas you very rarely offer surgery for symptom control, you would be much more keen to consider radiotherapy for symptom control. So in patients with multiple sites of recurrence, if one site is causing lots of symptoms like pain, typically, then you will consider radiotherapy to that site to improve the symptoms.
What are the different types of radiotherapy? Can patients be treated with multiple types of radiotherapy?
So IMRT is kind of standard radiotherapy, or people sometimes call it photon radiotherapy, and it's just that they're the sort of energy packets that these machines kind of fire at you when you're having radiotherapy. Protons or proton beam therapy are a different form of energy, but they are still kind of, you know, subatomic radiation. So there's still radiation exposure. Again, it's not really my area, but what I do know is that the main difference between photon radiotherapy and proton radiotherapy is about how it distributes or how it releases its energy. So protons, people are quite sort of excited about in some ways, because when you fire the beam at a patient, you can control where it drops its energy, and it drops it here and it doesn't come out the other side. Whereas with photons, it goes in, releasing its energy on the way in. You can try and aim for it to be mainly deposited in one area and it goes out the other side. And so it's about your off-target kind of tissue damage, really. So the issue around previous radiation exposure is still very relevant. You know, if you've had previous photons or standard IMRT or however people want to call it, you know, standard radiotherapy, then protons won't get around, or they won't entirely get around the issue of previous radiation exposure. The only sort of additional benefit is that it doesn't come out the other side, so you can sort of, you would reduce it a little bit, also, you know, to a degree. And just the final thing about radiotherapy, which is probably a little bit different to surgery, and I think in part it's because the risks of radiotherapy are considered a bit lower. So people sometimes give radiotherapy for a small number of sites of metastatic disease. So with surgery, you tend to, you know, if there's a single site, you might remove it. But once you start getting two or three or more sites, it wouldn't really be considered that the benefits outweigh any risks. With radiotherapy, it's still an open question, I would say. And you'll still get different opinions from different oncologists and different radiation oncologists. But for instance, across the NHS, the NHS commissions this service called stereotactic ablative radiotherapy, I think its term is, or SABR. But it's essentially, you know, high dose radiation for multiple sites of distant metastasis. And the NHS sort of line that it's drawn is up to three sites of distant metastasis, and it's with a controlled primary tumor and a greater than 6 month interval between their primary operation and a recurrence. And as I'm sure many people know, particularly with adenoid cystic salivary gland cancers, that's quite typical actually, that there's greater than 6 months progression-free interval, and it's quite typical that there's a controlled primary tumor. And often there is, you know, initially at least, just, you know, three or fewer sites of recurrence. So that's the other area in which radiotherapy is considered. Again, as I say, I don't do this, but I know when patients see a radiation oncologist to discuss radiotherapy for multiple sites of recurrence like this, it isn't presented as a curative option to patients. I think there will be people out there who've had a long interval after, and I'm sure there will be people out there for some cancer types that have had that done and not had any further recurrence at all. But it's not presented in that way, and we don't really, you know, have any. We don't have the evidence to say it is a curative treatment when you're giving it for multiple sites of recurrence. And really, it's about, conceptually, I think it's more about reducing the overall tumor burden in the body. And as Ian alluded to before, if you get kind of cancer cell seeding from sites of metastasis, if you're kind of reducing the sites of metastasis, then you're at least slowing down that reseeding and cell seeding. So that's how it's presented by the radiation oncologist to patients. And it's still an open question. And I know across the NHS, I think when patients have this, it's actually been done within a trial that's, and the data's been prospectively kind of collected, all the outcome data. So in probably 5 years' time, we'll know, at least know a bit better what the outcomes are. But it's not a randomized trial. Everyone who's having it is having it. So it will just be able to say, well, patients who had this radiotherapy for multiple sites of disease, these were the outcomes. And probably you'll be able to say if patients had an interval of 6 months versus an interval of 6 years, the outcomes are, and I would predict the outcomes are very different. The challenge is that those outcomes are probably different mainly because the underlying disease course is different in those sorts of patient groups. So it's hard to know how to interpret that. So that's the other thing about radiotherapy that's probably different to surgery.
Now let's talk about ablative therapy.
So ablative therapies, it's similar in concept again to surgery and radiotherapy in that these are localized treatments. What I mean by ablation just means like to, in a non-medical sense, to ablate something is to kind of, you know, destroy it. You know, there are different forms of ablative therapies. They generally involve a radiologist, sometimes a surgeon, but normally a radiologist, putting something into the tumor and either heating it up, cooling it down, microwaving it. And so you've got things like radio frequency ablation or microwave ablation or cryoablation. But they just stick something into the tumor that sort of dissolves it and ablates it. It fits a different kind of clinical area than surgery. So we talked about surgery, saying if you can get rid of it all, you operate. And ablation, you wouldn't do that. If you've got a single site you could operate on, you operate. You wouldn't want to ablate. But if you've got multiple sites, then sometimes you would say, well, a bit like we said with stereotactic radiotherapy for three sites of disease, sometimes you might say, if you've got three sites of disease, you want to, you may not be able to irradiate, but you might be able to ablate them. For organs like the liver very difficult to irradiate. You can irradiate them, but you risk exposing the liver to the radiotherapy and causing liver damage. So sometimes you might think that something like ablation will serve the same purpose. I think, unlike with stereotactic radiotherapy for up to three sites of disease, there isn't any clear kind of guidance. There's not a clear, in the UK at least, there's not a clear commissioning process in terms of what the NHS will or won't do. Lots of centres have liver specialist, multidisciplinary team meetings that advise on what to do with the liver. But you possibly find you get different opinions from different meetings. But in principle, I would consider it as a kind of overall reducing the tumour burden and not getting rid of all the disease that's there. And so the principle is you may be slowing down the disease, but not ablating it with curative intent. When I discuss it with patients, I always say, I often say something like, if you've got 20 sites or 30 sites of disease, then if you ablate two or three of them, you're not really likely to make much difference to the overall tumor burden, the overall amount of disease in the body. If you have 5 sites of disease and you can ablate 3 or 4 of them, then you may actually successfully reduce the overall tumor burden in the body by 80% or something. And in between is a bit of a sliding scale where the more that is there, the less of the disease you're actually basically treating. Ultimately, it's not a discussion with a medical oncologist. It depends which site of the body is affected and who is going to do it and what the risks are of intervening at that site of the body. But there are, the risk is you damage the tissue, you replace tumor tissue with scar tissue and dysfunctional tissue. So you're not likely to improve the function, and you would expect to get some additional complications. And in fact, if your tumor is that big and you want to ablate the tumor plus an area around it, you're replacing some defect in your organ of that size and it's becoming that size. So you would expect that there is a trade-off. But I know patients who've had ablation procedures, and I think generally that the driver that motivates people is to think, and now it's that big, but in 5 years' time, it might be, or in however long time, it'll be that big. And if I can make a defect that big but stop it getting bigger, then that's the kind of trade-off that people look for. I think ultimately it's quite a nuanced decision. Lots of clinicians make different decisions about it. Lots of patients will make very different decisions about it. And there's no clear, guidance about who should have ablations when. But I would say you just have to have a kind of detailed discussion with whoever's your oncologist in the first instance. And if you're speaking with someone about an ablation, you want to have a detailed discussion with whoever's carrying out the procedure. But that's where ablations kind of fit in these kind of intervention. And Bridget said, is seeding the same as ablation? I think that probably means there's this term called brachytherapy, which is these small seed, people call them sort of radiation seeds, but it's a similar sort of thing. Instead of putting a needle in and using microwaves or heat or cold or radio frequency, you put a needle in and leave a little metal seed that releases sort of radiation that stops within a certain distance of the seed. Conceptually, it's similar. It's the same idea. Yeah.
Is there data available about the success of ablation therapy?
Difficult. A bit like I said with this radiotherapy thing that the NHS are actually collecting over a number of years, what you'll end up having with ablation procedures is just series of case series, you will call them. So a single site that's done a whole load of ablation procedures will then or may then write them up and say, these were the patients that had ablation, these were the characteristics, the tumor types, the interval from their operation to recurrence, etc. These were the outcomes. But that's as good a data as you will get. But that in itself isn't that helpful, I don't think. And particularly to just think about adenoid cystic carcinoma, you know, a lot of people here know it's often a very indolent disease. And after a procedure, people will still often live a number of years. And so it's difficult to know, well, did the procedure alter that? Did they live a number of years because of that procedure? Would they have lived longer or less long with or without it? The only way you would get that is through some sort of randomized study, and they just don't exist. And I don't think they will ever exist, actually, with these sorts of interventions, you know, these sorts of treatments, because I think generally if someone has made, they've got to the point of saying that's something I want to explore, they don't want to be randomized to it or away from it. And similarly, if they're in a position where they're saying it's not something I want to explore, they don't want to be randomized to have it. So there's not, is the short answer.
Now let's move on to drug therapies.
So chemotherapy, people are often familiar with chemotherapies because these are the drugs that have been around for 50 years or longer, 70 years even, that are used in lots of cancer types. In salivary gland cancer, I would say almost every chemotherapy drug has been tested in salivary gland cancers. Normally, the patients have got any salivary gland cancer in a chemotherapy trial, so we don't have very good information actually about one drug versus another. In principle, the way chemotherapy drugs work is they damage dividing cells, and they work on the basis that the cancer cells are dividing, you know, more rapidly than most other cells in the body, but they aren't very selective. So they sort of target cell, you know, cell division. So if you've got a cancer that's rapidly dividing, then it will be more sensitive to, or theoretically more sensitive to, chemotherapy. If you've got a cancer that's not very rapidly dividing, and, you know, for instance, adenoid cystic is one like that, then you wouldn't really expect chemotherapy actually to be that effective. And that has sort of borne out in all the trials that we've seen with adenoid cystic carcinoma. I mean, that's probably all I'll say about chemotherapy for now. Immunotherapy, for the last 10 years, there's been a whole load of different studies across lots of tumor types of what you might call, you know, commercially developed, you know, off-the-shelf type immunotherapy. So they're not sort of bespoke therapies where they take your immune cells out of your body, go and engineer them in the lab and give them back to you. You buy in the drug and you give it to the patient. So these are the drugs that have had lots of success in tumor types like melanoma and lung cancers and common head and neck cancers and bladder cancers and things. They've been tested across salivary gland cancers and in adenoid cystic carcinoma. There's really patchy data on them. There's actually a reasonable amount of data in adenoid cystic just because there's more patients out there with adenoid cystic. The signal that's there is very similar to with chemotherapy. So the chance of benefit with adenoid cystic to immunotherapy is between 5% and 10% based on the trials that have been done. And again, it's not entirely surprising because of what we know about adenoid cystic, which is you don't get many immune cells in the tumor. They don't express these sort of standard immune markers that other tumors that tend to respond to immunotherapy express, like this one, some typical one, like PD-L1 is the one everyone sort of looks for. And they don't have lots of genetic mutations. And that's the other thing that people seem to see as a bit of a surrogate for response to immune therapies.
And what are targeted therapies?
So targeted therapies are where the sort of the stepwise, you know, improvements have been seen. So targeted therapies in principle are slightly different to chemotherapies. So instead of targeting cells that are dividing, they look at like the pathways in cells, how cells function, how the proteins are sort of functioning, and try and block pathways that are thought to be overactive, basically. Most of the studies of targeted therapies are actually in adenoid cystic salivary gland cancers rather than other non-adenoid cystic salivary gland cancers. The signal is a bit stronger. It's getting 10 to 15% response rates rather than, you know, 5 to 10% response rates. Frustratingly, I would say, the responses that we've seen haven't been, we can't, they've not been based on any matching process in patients. So we don't have a good predictor with patients to say, okay, well, if you've got this genetic change in your tumor or this protein that's overexpressed in your tumor, that you're going to respond to this this treatment. Now, there are real successes in other salivary gland cancers, and the big successes have been in, so there's a subtype called salivary duct carcinoma, which has two markers that it expresses. One is the androgen receptor and one is the HER2. And so this is a whole different subtype of salivary gland cancer than adenoid cystic. But the reason I say it is, or partly it's, we're trying to be slightly broader about salivary gland cancers, but these are, the androgen receptor is a marker that we see in prostate cancer normally. And all the kind of standard prostate cancer hormone therapies have very good response rates and benefit rates in androgen receptor positive salivary duct carcinoma. And HER2 is the marker that's expressed in about a third of breast cancers. And about a third of these salivary duct carcinomas express HER2. And all the HER2 targeted breast treatments work really well in these HER2 positive salivary glands, salivary duct carcinomas. But it is a very specific subset of salivary gland cancers that express androgen receptor in HER2. It's this salivary duct carcinoma, which is different from adenoid cystic carcinoma. It's tricky. They're still not entirely standard, but they're sort of becoming standard. The barriers to them becoming standard are around it, you know, being a rare cancer, being relatively limited numbers of patients treated. But they certainly are, I would say, internationally and in the UK, becoming standard treatments for those patients. And the other real sort of breakthrough in salivary gland cancer is in this subtype called secretory carcinoma, which again is a different, it's a very specific different subtype that isn't adenoid cystic. It's characterized by one particular genetic change in a gene, which is actually NTRK or NTRK, people call it sometimes. But there's a couple of drugs that have already been developed, tested, proven very effective in these NTRK altered tumor types, and in fact, in any tumor type with that same genetic change. There are track records, I would say, for kind of this matching process, and there's also a track record for what you might consider repurposing of drugs. You know, taking the setting of prostate cancer or breast cancer, finding the same markers and actually repurposing them in salivary gland cancers. And this NTRK is the same. I mean, it's basically just been studied from day one in tumors, irrespective of the tumor type, in tumors that have this NTRK fusion.
What about gene analysis? How can we use gene analysis to speed up getting new treatments and move things forward for us all?
Yeah, good questions. The first kind of line of thought there is around our understanding of genomics of different salivary gland subtypes and how we kind of can speed that up in terms of translating it to drug therapies, I think is what you're saying. And that's what I spend most of my time on. I mean, this is my area, I suppose, I would say. I would start by saying, though, it is an area of research. So we don't know in adenoid cystic or other salivary gland cancers, other than the examples I said. Okay, you get this match. Here's a drug that's proven. Or pretty much all of these other genetic changes that we find, including Notch in adenoid cystic, are still areas of research. So you find a mutation, you take the tumor sample, you do the sequencing, look for a different genetic changes, you find a mutation is actually to match someone to a trial that's then asking the question, is this trial therapy in a cancer type with this mutation effective? The only way we can speed it up is getting more patients and looking at more tumor samples and getting more people on trial. I think in the UK, we're doing pretty well in terms of the sequencing. We're able to get that far. Our challenge in the UK is trials. So we don't have Well, we certainly don't have lots of trials in salivary gland cancer. So a lot of our trials, other than NOTCH, for instance, are then for people with any tumor type. And that's probably the barrier in the, or, you know, the rate limiting step in the UK. If we could do one thing, it would be to improve things. It would be that we'd have more trials available for the matching. Is our barrier in the UK isn't doing the sort of sequencing, I would say. I think the other barrier is kind of, how do you make it a global effort, because it's such a rare cancer. So I think we sequence about maybe 100 and probably 100, 120 salivary gland cancer patients' tumors a year in terms of this matching for trials through our practice. But that's actually quite a small, it's a big number for one practice, but it's quite a small number if you think, well, how do you get people on trial and get the answer? So globally, you've got to say, well, how do we tie it up with other centres? And we do, Emma and I are both part of this International Rare Cancers Initiative salivary gland group. And in that, there's, you know, input from the European leads, like based in Italy and the Netherlands and the US sites, that are all kind of really active researchers, both patient-based and laboratory-based researchers in salivary gland cancer. And so it's tied up in a sense that the conversations are happening on a joint level, but actually, how do you get the trials to happen on a joint level? And that really is difficult because every country's got its own sort of governance sort of framework that you've got to go through to set up a trial, basically. So it's not that easy. They're the things I would say, you know, they're the barriers I would say to speeding it up. I've forgotten the second part of your question now.
About COVID.
It was about the possibility of using the vaccines.
Yeah, in adenoid cystic, for instance, as you say, there's this MYB gene fusion. So patients, one challenge is every patient's gene fusion isn't the same. So often the break point is a bit different, but you could sequence an individual's gene fusion. You might predict that then you have an abnormal protein that goes with that's expressed. And then, so you might have a very bespoke, you know, tumor specific mutation. And in the same way, they're talking about changing the COVID vaccine. You say, well, you sequence the coronavirus and you just put the new sequence in. You could have a kind of bespoke vaccine based on what mutation you know that patient has. I mean, that sort of research is happening. It's not really happening in MYB adenoid cystic, but there are cancer vaccine studies that are happening. One of my concerns, though, about cancer vaccines is, to date, they don't have a very good track record. So cancer vaccines have been studied for, you know, years. And maybe it's just that it's the wrong technology, or maybe it's just the wrong sort of target that's been picked. So I still think it's worth pursuing, but it's still an avenue for research, really. But I think it's quite an active, as you said, BioNTech have that was how they set up, I think, was looking at cancer vaccines first.
Lastly, can we hear about radioimmunotherapy, please?
So it's just conceptually what it's about, which is, so in adenoid cystic, there's a study looking at, it's called PSMA radio-labeled therapy. But basically, the concept is you look for a marker that's specific to the tumour, and then you give an antibody that sort of migrates around the body to that marker, and it's got a kind of radioactive sort of molecule on the end. So you can then selectively deliver radiation to theoretically any site of the body that the tumor is in. So that's the idea behind these radio label therapies. And yeah, I think it's the Netherlands are running this study. You know, they first showed that adenoid cystic have high levels of this particular marker, PSMA. And they're running a study looking at this radio-labeled therapy, PSMA radio-labeled antibody therapy. So I think they're quite a standard treatment approach, and there's actually a realistic chance that it could be effective. So I think I'm quite excited to see what the study shows.
You've been listening to Dr. Robert Metcalf at Salivary Gland Cancer UK's April meeting. Join our network to stay posted for further events, further podcasts, and hopefully an in-person meeting later in 2021.